afternoon.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
And we are in Parakutet chapter 19. We are getting ready to actually start the story. Last time, after we finished the Pesel Micha elements and Moshe's grandson and all of that, we introduced this story by noting that this story, like Pesel Micha, like the idol of Micha, is assumed to be dislocated from its original time. Granted, Abarbanel and Radak think that it actually happens at the end of the period. Everybody else seems to think that it happens in the beginning and then it's pushed to the end for reasons we've already discussed. We talked about some of the common elements of these two stories as well. And at the end, we addressed the question of whether to view this story as some kind of a polemic against Shaul and Binyamin, in favor of the house of King David, in favor of the tribe of Yehuda, because, you know, Binyamin is going to be painted awfully in this story, and Yehuda is going to lead the war against Binyamin. And the story does overlap with elements of Shaul's career, like the fact that this terrible city of Gibeah is actually the place that Shaul comes from. Nonetheless, we noted from Yechezkel Kaufman that that's really hard to support. If it's a polemic, it's not well done, because it's never used later in Tanakh. No one in the time of Shaul and David mentions this story or anything negative about Shaul coming from Gibeah or anything like that. Shaul is always treated with respect, even when he is at his low point. Binyamin never loses their status after this story. We don't look down on Binyamin later on, even within the story itself. Binyamin is still viewed as a tribe of Israel. And when the kingdom fundamentally splits after the time of Shlomo, Binyamin stays with Yehuda in the southern kingdom, and everybody else is the one that goes north. Ephraim becomes the leader of the northern kingdom. So it's kind of hard to sustain it, even though superficially you look at it and say, well, Binyamin against Yehuda, Shaul and David, and it seemed to match up. The last element of introduction that we have to talk about is the Pilegesh herself. Pilegesh being a concubine, because it's not just this is what happened. In other words, within the story, the Pilegesh is going to be abused and killed. But it's not just this is what happens within the plot, and it happens to be that she is a Pilegesh, but it could be that the fact that there is a Pilegesh is itself part of the story. Is itself part of what the story is trying to teach. So we need to understand what a Pilegesh is. So Pilegesh is usually translated as concubine, and I couldn't resist. Maybe I should have. But source number one. This happened 20 years ago. Now a little more than 20 years ago. Isn't that terrible? Does anyone remember this story?
No.
Nope. This was a big deal in the late 90s, 95, 96, 97. There was an organization called the Shalom Bayis Organization, Shalom Bayis, Peace in the Home, that claimed that they had rabbis supporting the idea of resurrecting the concept of a Pilegesh in Judaism. Pilegesh meaning, we'll come back to in greater depth, but Pilegesh meaning on a basic level, a relationship between a man and a woman without benefit of a ketubah, without benefit of kiddushin, and not requiring a get if they decide to break it off.
How is that different from a boyfriend and girlfriend?
So this is the second one.
No, there doesn't need to be a wife. This is just.
Oh, it doesn't have to be a wife.
Correct.
I always call concubine.
So the answer essentially is only that during the duration of this relationship, she is required to be monogamous to the husband. He's not a husband. The husband is
right. The significant other.
Right.
But what about the significant other?
Yeah. Right. So
he's required to be.
It's not a matter of a double standard. This goes back to the days of...
It's different.
I'll talk eventually. I recognize the topic of... No, this is the topic of fascination. I get it. But the answer is this goes back to the period of polygamy. And therefore you wouldn't expect any requirement of monogamy from him to her. It's only going to be that she would be monogamous to him and not the other way around. So the major differences are she doesn't have the protections of a halachic marriage. All of his financial responsibilities for her, the requirement that in the event of divorce he has to pay her the ketubah and all of that, she has none of those protections whatsoever. On the other hand, she can walk away anytime. It simply ends when she moves out. So that's the basic relationship. So in this mid-90s period, this Shalom Bayis organization says, you know, that's a better option for people as opposed to being stuck when they're in a marriage and it's not working out, so they should just, you know, find a concubine. They claim they had rabbis to support it. They claim that they had women who were interested in actually becoming Pilag Shot. And they had a phone number that men should call and leave a message if you're interested in this.
I remember single women going to the mikvah in New York at one point, like
because
it was okay.
This I don't know.
Like what's the? It's just like living together.
But basically, just living together, isn't it?
Yes.
Right. It's a common law. So common, like, yeah, but you have a wife too. It's a common law.
Correct, but it didn't have to be. In other words, they're proposing, if you're looking at the source in number one, which is just, I picked one random newspaper article about it from The Independent, the news made it to England. So the organization said that they are catering to situations in which there is a marriage in which there is unhappiness, and having the concubine available might actually help improve the happiness of the marriage. That's their...
He's happiness, not her.
You know...
Maybe.
You know, I mean, look, there are all sorts of things you could say that I'm not going to.
Does the wife know about this?
Let's be very clear.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
If you go back to Chumash, Avraham had Pilag Shiv. Right?
Avraham had Pilag Shiv.
I mean, Hagar was not a Pilagish. Hagar is actually Isha, as the Pasuk says. It's very specific. Avraham, when it actually, as Ramban notes there, Sarah insists that he should take Hagar as an Isha, as a wife. The Pilag Shiv only happened after Sarah is gone. After Sarah passes away, Avraham then marries Pilag Shiv. It's not marriage. That's part of the discussion halachically of, is this considered marriage? But it exists there. This concept of pilagish already is seen there. There's one point in the Chumash where Bilhah is depicted as a pilagish of Yaakov. It's very unclear. That relationship between Bilhah, Zilpah, and Yaakov, where sometimes they are wives, sometimes they are shvachot, and then you have Bilhah called Pilagesh Aviv when Reuven has that weird story.
What's the difference between a shivcha and
Pilagesh?
Why is a servant?
A shivcha is not married to him at all. A shivcha is not supposed to be married to him.
No, but that's cool.
Yeah.
What's the difference between Pilagesh and, shall I say, a girlfriend? Or just anyone?
And the answer only is that it's the monogamy aspect of it and the fact that they're living together.
But according to this, so the man has to be married?
No. Again, what I'm saying here in number one is that's what they were offering. But that's not...
It doesn't have to be.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So, you know, the term itself, the term Pilagesh, is explained by Rav Yaakov Emden to be a contraction of Peleg Isha. Peleg Liflog is split. It means half. It's half marriage.
And there's no issue of money here. It's not like a zonah. Like,
there may be an issue of money only in the sense that you ask yourself, why would a woman do this? What is in this for her? The answer may well be that this was something where he promises to take care of her, not in a, you know, in a halachic framework. But he says that he's going to look after her. That's the basic idea. The Gemara itself, in its Sanhedrin Chaf Aleph, seems to indicate there's no Kiddushin, there's no Ketubah. There are those who make the argument that in the case in Pilagish B'Giv'ah, there actually were Kiddushin, because at one point it's going to use what sounds like marriage terminology. But the basic assumption is that this is a standard Pilagish, without Ketubah, without Kiddushin.
Isn't one of the definitions of marriage sleeping with each other?
And therefore?
They don't have to actually have a ketubah. They're considered married.
Oh, I see. Yeah. No, you're asking something different. I'm sorry. You're asking the question of a means of halachically affecting marriage. Could it be just by sleeping together they will have done that? The answer is no. Not without a ketubah and not without kiddushin. Kiddushin you could have. They could sleep together and count that as kiddushin, but you would still need the brachot that are recited with a minyan presence.
Can I ask you a question? You said that they can leave anytime they want, right?
Yeah.
When Cain was like a Hashverosh had all these problems, they weren't allowed to leave once they were in that.
That's because he's a Persian king. That didn't have anything to do with Torah law. When you look at the institution of Pilagesh, you find it, as I said, in Chumash. You find it with David HaMelech, that David has Pilag Shot. Theoretically, it should be Pilag Shot, I would think, but Pilag Shim is what's found in the Chumash.
And why can he have... Oh, not at the same time.
Sorry?
Isn't the point that it was exclusive?
No.
Sorry, what are you asking?
Didn't we just say before that it...
He can have more than one pilagesh, yes.
At a time.
Yes. So it appears, anyway.
He's living together, he's not necessarily always under the same roof with her. He's just
Correct.
He's part of the...
Right.
Yeah,
right. Living together is more of a euphemism.
Okay.
The...
kept woman.
Yeah, that's probably the best term for it. So the question is this a real thing, halachically? Like, does this, you know, have anything to support it? So the Rambam said, no, not unless your name begins with the word king. Take a look at source number 2. The Rambam writes, this is a discussion of laws of kings. It says, the king may take wives and concubines from all Israel. Nashim b'ketubah b'kiddushin, wives with the benefit of ketubah and kiddushin, just like normally happens. Upilakshim below ksuba below kiddushin, as we said. Concubines without ketubah or kiddushin. Ela b'yichud bilvat kone osa umuteres lo. Simply by the fact that she is designated as his pilagesh. That's it. Now she is permissible to him as a pilagesh. Abal hahedyot, but a regular person, a sorba pilagesh, is not allowed to have a pilagesh. There are a few halachic problems with the institution of pilagesh. I'll give you 3 of them. One problem is, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin notes, there is a rabbinic prohibition against a single woman being alone with a man who is not her husband, or the man being alone with her, either way, whichever way you want to look at it, the prohibition goes both ways. In other words, just like there is a biblical prohibition against a man being alone with a woman who is married to somebody else, there's a rabbinic prohibition against being alone with a single woman. It's instituted, as the Gemara tells it, after the story with Amnon and Tamar.
A married woman is okay?
No, it's biblically prohibited. Biblically prohibited with a married woman, rabbinically prohibited with a single woman. Yeah. Don't do this. Correct. Okay.
But as long as the door wasn't locked, it was okay.
So the question of the application of this rule depends a lot on circumstances, meaning what constitutes alone. So there may be those who will say that in the event that the door is not locked, maybe that doesn't constitute being alone. I think realistically in our society that's a weak type of justification, because no one walks into somebody's house, generally speaking, uninvited, and so the fact that somebody could walk in because the door isn't locked doesn't really help you. And there are all sorts of nuances to this. You know, what if the husband is in the same city and could come home any time? What if there's a window and someone could see? What if there are people who are told to come check in at some point, you know, at random? There are all sorts of different nuances to this in terms of the laws of Yichud. But the basic principle is not to be alone together, and clearly here, you know, you're defying that. Because, you know, she is a single woman, as far as we're concerned, until you enter into this pilagish relationship. So that's one problem. Second problem, the Gemara in Ksuvos in source number 3 talks about a very important rule. When I used to be a shul rabbi and I would conduct a wedding, I would make sure to mention this rule to the couple under the chuppah. Achse derami barchama havas nesiva l'Rav Avya. Rami Bar Chama, a sage from the period of the Gemara, has a sister. She is married to Rav Avya. Irkas Ksubasa. She lost her Ksuba. Asul Kameh to Rav Yosef. So they came to Rav Yosef and asked, what do we do? Amar lo, hachi amar Rav Yehuda amar Shmuel. He said, so says Rav Yehuda, quoting Shmuel, zu divrei Rabbi Meir. This is the view of Rabbi Meir, meaning the view that says you can't live together if you don't have the Ksuba document. But the Chachamim, though, say, no, they can be that way 2 or 3 years without a Ksuba. Amar le Abaye, to which Abaye said, but we follow Rabbi Meir. The Amar of Nachman, Amar Shmuel, halachic Rabbi Meir, b'gzeir asav. The rule follows Rabbi Meir regarding his decrees, and this is a decree, that they should not be together without the Ksuba. To which he says, Yahachi zok sablas, so go write her a new Ksuba. And that is indeed the rule. A man and a woman are not allowed to live together without benefit of a Ksuba. In the event that the Ksuba is lost, it's very easy to write a replacement. It's called Ksuba di Irkasa. I've done it for people. And that's what's supposed to happen.
What happens in a case of war where people move countries, says how do you prove, how does one prove?
Proof is not required. You just write a new document about it.
Everyone can go and say.
They go to, yeah. It's not, if the rabbi has reason to believe that they're not actually married, you know, then there may be a call for investigation. But generally speaking, no one has a reason to lie and say, yes, we really are married. You're making things more restrictive for yourself by doing that. You come to a place where you could be passing off yourself as single, and you're going to claim to you, hey, if you want to do that, why don't you just get married?
Well, in my case, my parents got married in Siberia. They were not allowed to be married. They were hiding their marriage. They certainly didn't have a ketubah. If I were to get married today, I couldn't prove that my parents were married. I suppose there are exceptions for the war.
Right. Well, why would you need to prove that your parents were married?
Well, nowadays, if I were to get married for young women, would I not need to prove that my parents were married?
Two different things. To prove you're Jewish, maybe. To prove they were married, we don't care.
Well, again, I don't be able to. I don't have any documents for my
right.
Parents.
So that's a different story. If you wanted the document to prove being Jewish, that would be another story.
What if one of her parents was divorced and then got married.
But generally speaking, the ksuba won't testify one way or another about
right.
that anyway.
Right.
So it won't be an issue. But if you wanted a document to prove that you're Jewish, that would indeed be a separate point. But the ksuba, the irkasa, which is what it's called when you write a ksuba that replaces one that's been lost, won't really speak to that anyway. Because you have to remember what a ksuba document is. What a ksuba document is fundamentally is it plays two roles. The one role is that it documents that the husband understands that he's accepting a whole bunch of responsibilities for his wife. That's what the document primarily does. It lists what he is supposed to do for her. And then it also is a document memorializing the agreement that in the event of his death or in the event of divorce, then he will pay her, or his estate will pay her, a certain sum of money. That's what the ksuba document does. So you have a problem. Let's say the woman comes to the rabbi. It doesn't have to be a rabbi, but comes to the rabbi and says, you know, we lost the original. Or she goes to her husband and says, you know, generally the ksuba is supposed to be in the possession of the wife because it memorializes his obligations to her. So what if she says one day, I lost the document, right? But in fact, she's hiding it with the goal that later on, she could claim her ksuba payment, and they're going to take the document at that time, or they're going to do something to disqualify it when she makes the claim for the ksuba payment, and then she's going to have another one. She has a backup. And she is going to, let's say they get divorced one day. She claims the ksuba with her original document. Then the document is disqualified, invalidated in some way so that it can't be used to claim it anymore. And then a year later, she goes to another Beit Din and she says, you know, my husband and I got divorced. I never claimed the ksuba money. Here's my ksuba. So what you do is, none of this is relevant in our world because you don't claim the ksuba.
Don't they rip up ksuba?
Either you can rip it up, you can invalidate it. There are all sorts of things that you can do, but the point isn't that. The point is that first of all, no one in Canada is ever going to claim a ksuba payment off of the ksuba document. There are all sorts of reasons why a secular court will never recognize the validity of the ksuba as a document in order to claim an amount of money. For starters, the fact that nobody at the time of the wedding actually knows what they're agreeing to, because they don't actually... I mean, I used to explain to people what it was. No, I used to... No, there are no camels and horses mentioned. Even though I used to explain to people what was in the ksuba, still, zikukin is the currency that's mentioned. No, I mean, there's a great debate as to what zikukin are in modern currency. Now, true Sfard tzuvot, if you ever go to a Sfard wedding here, you'll hear it, because they read it out loud, they sing it out loud, actually. They mention Canadian dollars. They mention Canadian dollars, which is a little stronger.
How much?
That depends on who's getting married.
Everybody listens to the
That's why Ashkenazim. That's why Ashkenazim. Sfaradim are a lot more fun. There's a lot more to.
What's the point of assigning it in today's age? It can't be used for anything.
So the answer is it is still valid in terms of binding him for a ksuba payment. It's just that we don't do it. What we do instead is there's a financial agreement that the former husband and wife come to, using the court, using lawyers, whatever they use, in order to do it. They come up with their own financial agreement, and she forgives the ksuba payment. But it's still important as something that binds him to this and binds him to all the other obligations that he has. He has to pay her medical bills. He'd have to ransom her if she were taken captive. All the different things that he agrees to. He has to get a job. All the things that are there in the ksuba.
That's
yes,
there. You have to get a job?
Yeah. It says that he is going to pay her whatever it is and support her and give her food and everything else from himself and even from the shirt off his back. That's what the ksuba says. So the Rush, writing about 800 years ago, dealing with a case that was being litigated in which the husband was not supporting her, and he said, well, I don't have any money. So he said, okay, but based on your ketuba, you're obligated to get a job in order to pay her. It isn't that you can just say, well, I don't have any money to give her. So you know, there is that element as well. But we're getting a little far afield.
Is it necessary for a rabbi to marry, or can anyone marry?
No, anybody. What you need is two witnesses who will be accepted as kosher witnesses. They have Shabbat observant, and yes, male. And you require for the nisuin, that's the initial stage, and then for the nisuin, you will also require that the brachot be made, the seven brachot be made in the presence of a minyan. That's what you require.
Her, like,
well, that's from the kedushin. He'll have to give her something of value, right? That's what the two witnesses.
Kedushin or the
The first
the kiddushim. I thought you only need to do the kiddushim.
The kiddushin is your first stage, and then nisuin. You can't have if you do kiddushin and you don't do nisuin, then they're prohibited to each other and to the rest of the world.
I didn't have a
shabbat brachot. Not a shabbat brachot meal. The seven blessings we recite under the chuppah.
I don't remember which one.
No, they probably would have done that along with the kiddushin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't
worry. Well, yeah. My daughter was married in New York, and everybody was out of town, so they did the sheva brachot. They did under the chuppah.
Yeah. Sheva brachot are always done under the chuppah. The sheva brachot meal is a completely different thing. So the pilegesh doesn't have the ketubah document, and since we do indeed follow the view of Rabbi Meir in source number 3, that should prohibit them to each other. And that's the second reason why this is a problem. The third reason is a policy issue. In the event that you will allow this, since, as Roberta noted, they don't actually have to be living under the same roof, and since the relationship is so loose that it doesn't have documentation, you didn't have a big wedding ceremony and so on, you could actually end up with situations in which relatives marry each other without ever knowing it. This is essentially a way to produce children without registering the marriage anywhere.
Lakach lo isha, doesn't that usually mean married? So how can it be isha and pilegesh, or did I miss that?
So I remember if I said it before or after you walked in, but indeed there is a view that says that here there was kiddushin because it uses the term isha.
So why wasn't she pilegesh?
Well, that's the problem. That's the reason to reject that view, is the answer has to be that, yes, it was Pilagish, and we're just using that term for both a husband in terms of marriage and the guy in a Pilagish relationship. We're going to get there. We haven't read the Psukim yet, so when we come back to it, I'll explain more. So the Rambam's view is there's no such thing as Pilagish unless you are the king. Ramban and Rabbi Yaakov Emdin do have arguments to justify Pilegesh beyond that. The bottom line out of this, though, is the relationship as described here in our story may well be, it's likely halachically fine. Except for the ketubah question, it's likely halachically fine. And the reason I say that is because it is before the story of Amnon and Tamar. And therefore, a man and a woman who are single, a man and a single woman could be alone together. So that problem doesn't exist. And the issue of the ketubah may be before the decree that you need to have a ketubah at all times. You know, the question is, what else is Maimonides, is Rambam, depending on what he says, that it only is valid for a king? That will be our outstanding question. But then here's the major point. What does a relationship like this reflect? How does something like this come into existence? Why is there a Pilagesh? And I think this will be borne out in the story, I think that the reason for something like this to exist is fundamentally money. I think you have two situations in which a Pilagesh will come to exist. Either she needs a means of supporting herself and decides that this is something she'd like to do. Or her father needs money, can't support her, and he makes the arrangement.
So why not
marry her? Because the guy doesn't want to marry her. Because the guy doesn't want the responsibility that comes with it. Marrying her comes with a whole host of responsibilities he'd like to avoid.
But if she's doing it for financial reasons, what's she get from it? He doesn't have to give her anything.
She has a place to live.
Right, and the answer is, though, if he doesn't continue to pay her, she walks out.
Right. So, but then she's already
soiled.
If she has a child, the child belongs to him and to her. I mean, the way the children. Does he have the same responsibilities for them? Is a good question.
Right.
With Gidon, we have. Yeah.
And if she walks away.
I'm not sure what the responsibility for the child is. It's a good question. Sorry?
Yeah, if she walks away with a child.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good question. I think so, but I'm not sure.
She also doesn't have anywhere to go.
Correct.
I don't know.
Correct. Yeah.
What's the difference between that and prostitution?
Only the fact that she remains with him. She doesn't have the ability to go to somebody else until they divide up, until she walks out on the relationship as a whole, keeping in mind that there's also a 3-month period in which she wouldn't be able to be with somebody else because we have a general concern for determining paternity in case she's pregnant. So she would have she would have 3 months before she could take up a new relationship. Okay. So I think it's important to identify the money factor, whether it's the factor in terms of the father arranging this, or whether it's her own desire for support. I think it's important to identify it because we've already seen the element of money and greed play such a big role in the story of Micha. Right, the preceding story, it was such a big theme. It was the Levi who was looking for support and said he'll go work in this house of idolatry or syncretism or whatever this is, and then along come people who make him a better offer, and then he'll go with them, and then the tribe of Dan isn't happy with their land, and so they're going to go take away the land from the people of Laish living up north. The whole element of what people will do in order to get money is so strong in this section that I feel like the fact that the story is introduced with a Pilegish is not simply that happened to be who she was, but I think it's a plot point. I think that's part of what we're meant to learn from here. Yeah. Okay. I haven't seen others make that point, but it just jumps out at me here. Okay. So now let's take a look. Let's actually start the story. Perek Yud Tet, chapter 19, the opening 3 psukim. Vayehi bayamim ahem. And it was back in the day. Umelach ein b'Yisrael. Right? Once again, there is no king in Israel, and therefore people do what they want. It didn't actually say here, and people do what they want, but we know it. We've seen it before, and we'll see it again by the end of the story. Vayehi ish Levi gar b'yarkisei har Ephraim. There was another Levi. Levi is living by the side of Har Ephraim, because again, everything's in Har Ephraim. Vayikachlo isha pilegesh mi Beit Lechem Yehuda, and he takes a pilegesh from Beit Lechem Yehuda. We talked about this already earlier when we talked about common denominators between the two stories, right? So I think we already noted that in the story of the idol of Micha, a Levi is living in Beit Lechem Yehuda and goes to Har Ephraim. Here, a Levi is living in Har Ephraim and goes to Beit Lechem Yehuda. It's an interesting, interesting. No, he's off in Laish now. Vatizne alav pilasho. Vatelech meitav al beis avia. Now that's a loaded word to translate. It has been loaded since we started Yahushua, and we wanted to know what it meant with Rachav. What do your translations have for the verb in the beginning of sentence two? Vatizne. Deserted.
Turned away from him.
Deserted him. Any other translations in the beginning of sentence two?
Deserted. Against him and
okay.
Went away from him.
Okay, hang on. Hang on. What do you have?
Yeah.
Same? Okay.
She said
music. Yeah, no, she said it.
Doesn't come from the word
Zonah. Yeah. So that's the question, is what in the world does the word Vatizneh mean? It's very odd, because Vatizneh love Pilag show, right? She, if you're going to say it means, you know, that she was with somebody else, Vatelech Meitawa Beisavia, she left him and she went to her father's house. That's not Zanut. This is a Pilagish relationship. She can break the relationship whenever she wants. And then why did she go to her father's house?
What else?
Where else are you going
to
go?
To the guy she was with.
It doesn't say she was with the guy.
No, but if Vatizneh is Zanut, if that's what it means. I don't understand what happened. Vatehi sham yamim arba'a chadashim. And she's there for quite some time. She is there for 4 months. Vayakam isha, and the husband gets up. And again, as Ricky noted, isha, her husband, sounds like it's a marriage relationship. But, and some do suggest that, but I think not. I think it's simply that we don't have a male, we don't have another word. Yeah, we don't have another word for the male in a Pilagish relationship. So Isha is just what we use.
Could be a name also.
Unlikely. We're not going to get any names in this story. We're going to come back to that point. Vayelech acharas. He goes after her. L'daber al liba, to speak to her heart. L'hashiva, to bring her home. V'naro imo, he has the youth with him. V'tzemet chamorim, and a pair of donkeys. V'tvi'eyu beis aviha. And she brings him to her father's house. Vayirehu avia na'ara. And the girl's father sees him. Vayismach likraso. And he was so happy to see him. So, what questions do we have here on these psukim? Aside from what in the world does Vatizneh mean?
Why did it take him 4 months?
Yeah.
Why?
Took you 4 months.
Is she willing now to take him back to her father's house?
And why did she?
And where did he go to get her? If she took him back to the house, where did he find her? Like, where was she?
And her father's
no, but then no. He took him to her father.
I mean, it doesn't sound quite like that. It's hard to say.
Like, was she in the market and he tracked her down? Like,
either that or he came to the house and she knocked on the door and she came out and she said, you can...
It sounds like she...
But why did she bring him to the father's house? Why welcome him if you left? Right? What happened?
Maybe she needed her father to support her. Like, yeah. You know, if she had a grievance or whatever... She needed
back there.
Right.
But
it doesn't
bring
into
that.
If she could have liked him, it doesn't say why she left him.
She might
have liked him, but not wanted to live with him.
Right. And now she changed her mind?
Okay.
Or she's being hospitable?
Yes. Either. Maybe the two donkeys are like indicative that it's like Nabola, what you call it. Sorry, my words aren't coming.
Yes, so a trading
document, like to say, like, mm-hmm. I wasn't really looking after you when you were living with me, so here, this is to prove that my intentions are pure, and here is like money to
Right. I don't know if pure is quite the word I would use, but yes, I think we're gonna see later on that the donkeys are loaded with wealth. It's not just donkeys. The
the father wanted the money.
Yeah.
The father is so happy to see him. You haven't even seen what's coming. You may have, but we're going to see what's coming next, and it's really going to be striking. So, in terms of this vatizne, what is this vatizne? So, multiple points of view. Take a look at source number 4, Radak. Radak turns to the Targumim, the Aramaic commentaries, and he says Targum ubasart. The term in Aramaic is ubasart. Where do I know that word from? Targum Devar Hashem Baza. We have a text, a biblical text, that says, Ki Devar Hashem Baza Ves Mitzvasel Hefar. He says there, when the text says, he has scorned the word of God elsewhere, the translation in Aramaic is, again, Basar. So he says, the term here is one of scorn. Rotza Lomar Bizta Oto. She scorned him. V'yatz'ami beso, she left his house, v'achala beisavi, and she went to her father's house. O yehye perusho, znus kemashma'o, or it means zinut, it means infidelity, the way it sounds. He offers you two explanations. Again, I think the reason why he doesn't like the idea that it's infidelity is just because the sentences don't read right, if it is. If she went off to be with somebody else, right, she can end her pilegish relationship and go be with the other guy. It doesn't make sense to call it zinut. And he notes, correctly, that the word liznot is not limited to a case of immorality. He notes that here it could be translated as she mocked him, but Rashi takes what is the most common use. I don't know if it's the most common use, but certainly a common use of the word liznot, which is to go away from. Moshe predicts to the Jews, that after his death, the nation will rise up, and they will stray after the gods of the land.
But it's always a negative.
Doesn't it always have?
Yeah. Oh, definitely always negative. Yeah, this is where I'm supposed to be, and Zona is to leave where I'm supposed to be. Absolutely.
And it's a pubescent boy's favorite.
Probably not. Take a look at number 5, though, just to see Rashi. Zantami beito alachutz. She left his house to go outside. That's why Rashi reads it. Kol lashon zinut eino el lashon yotzeit. It means to depart. Sandy, you were saying?
I think when you use the parallel with Hashem and going after another god, that's like having an affair too.
Well, yeah. Meaning the terms. This is
unfaithful.
Right. It's the etymology fundamentally. To leave where I'm supposed to be and go to someone else or something else is the origin of its use for infidelity. Also, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Stray is a very good word you use.
Yeah, I think stray is reasonable as a translation. The Talmud actually goes with this meaning of she left, but it does some interesting things, and I had to ellipsize the Gemara a little bit because some of it is just too explicit for me to do in this class. But I think I still retained the meaning of it in source number 6. What the Gemara here is doing, and I added it in brackets to make it clear, is it plays on two different meanings of Zayin Nun. One meaning is, as we're using it here, to stray. Another meaning, though, is Mazon, right? Go all the way back to Rachav, right? And the two different explanations for Rachav Hazona, and we said either it means that she was the maintainer of an inn, right, where she would give people food, or she was the more traditional understanding of Zona. We have both explanations. We even had the idea that it could be both. It's playing on that meaning of the word Zinut and how it could be associated either way.
That's right, Zona.
Precisely. So take a look at source number 6. Rabbi Eviatar, the Gemara is talking about something completely different and only ends up in this conversation because it mentions Rabbi Eviatar, and so now we go off on Rabbi Eviatar. Rabbi Eviatar hu da'askim mare al yadei. Rabbi Eviatar was the one whose master, meaning God, agreed with him. What do you mean? Dichsiv, the text says, Vatizne alav pilag show. His concubine left him, and then it tells about two different views about what happened within the house, and what it says in the part that I skipped is that the husband got angry because of something, and the something was either he wasn't happy about the food that she gave him, there was a fly in the soup, or alternatively, the husband got angry because of something to do with Zinut. Those are the two explanations the Gemara brings for what it was that happened. But the guy got angry at her, and she walked out. And then the Gemara continues. V'ashkichei Rabbi Aviatar le'Eliyahu. Rabbi Aviatar encountered Eliyahu Hanavi. Because you're in the Gemara, that's what happens in the Gemara. Amar le Maika Aved HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says to Eliyahu, tell me, what is God doing right now? Amar le Asik Pilegesh Begiva. He said, God's involved in the story of Pilegesh Begiva, of the concubine. God is learning Shoftim. Umayka, all sorts of commentaries to this, and what are the deeper meanings? I'm not going there. That's not the point for right now. So Umayka Amar, he said, well, what is God saying? So Amar le, he said, God is saying, Eviatar b'ni kahu omer, Yonatan b'ni kahu omer. The two voices in the dispute about what it was that got the guy angry, Rabbi Eviatar and Rabbi Yonatan, God quotes them both. God quotes Rabbi Eviatar, that he says, this is what happened, and he quotes Rabbi Yonatan, that he says, this is what happened. So Rabbi Eviatar is horrified. Amar le, the English continues on the other side. Amar le, he said, Chas v'shalom mi'ika speka kame shemaya. He says, can that possibly be? God doesn't know what happened? What do you mean? Like, why is God quoting Rabbi Eviatar says he was angry because of this? Rabbi Yonatan says he was angry because of that. You're God. Just tell the story straight. So Amar Lei, to which he replies with the famous words, Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim hein. Both of these are, in fact, the words of the living God, or the living words of God, depending on how you translate that line. And as the Gemara goes on, it says that actually both events happened, but the first thing that happened didn't get the guy angry. The second thing that happened was really what got him angry, and both of them are encapsulated in the word, batizneh, and that's where they drew the idea of what happened. But therefore, both statements, in fact, are true. That's the read of the Gemara. So when we say this and this are true, even though it doesn't sound like they could be, they actually are. But the Gemara then takes this in a different direction. Amar Rav Chisda said, La olam al yatil adam ema yisera besoch beso. You should never instill excessive fear in the home. Shari pilegish begivah hitil la habala ema yisera behipila kama rivos mi yisrael. This whole story doesn't begin except because he flies off the handle. Therefore she goes away, therefore he goes after her, and therefore what happens on their return trip happens, and look at everything that developed. All because he got angry like that. Now, obviously there are a lot of different elements of this story. This is not the direct cause, but the Gemara wants to teach us a lesson about getting angry. Note that it says Eima Yisera, excessive anger. Excessive anger is no good. Right? It's actually not excessive anger. The truth is, did I say fear or fear? It's excessive fear. That's a better one. Right, because it's Ema. The excessive fear. There is a notion found already in the Gemara, and the Rambam talks about this as well, that it is healthy for there to be a level of, fear is the right word, but to be a level of care in the house of, we don't want to do things that are wrong. Such that if your kids do something and they need to understand this is really wrong, the Rambam says you should not be angry at them, but you should pretend to be angry just for the sake that they should learn you can't do whatever it is that we're talking about. And parents in general have to have a point where they'll say, for this I have to display anger, even if I'm not really angry. They have to understand this is serious. So that's what Rav Chisda is saying here is, it's all well and good to say there are certain things for which everyone in the household has to know this is a red line that can't be crossed, but you can't go beyond that. And that's what he did, and that's what chases her out. And then last line from the Gemara, Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav, Kol Amatil Ema Yisera V'Soch Beiso, Sof Hu Ba Lidei Shalosh Averos. He says, if you do instill excessive fear in the home, you will come to three sins: gili arayos, immorality, shvichus dam, and bloodshed, v'chilul Shabbos, and Shabbos desecration. And then he goes on with his deduction of how you know it. So what the Gemara here is describing is a relationship which involved an element of abuse. He flew off the handle. He was in this rage. And she walked out.
So why do you use it if she left him? I know it means to turn away or to scorn, but it implies something about her using that word.
Yeah.
So if it wasn't her fault, why would they use that word if it was he who became angry?
Could have been that she looked towards someone and he, I'm just saying in relationships, that he misinterpreted it
right.
And therefore felt like she might stray and was jealous. It could be that she didn't.
Well, when the Gemara,
I know somebody no, when, happened to you, that's what I'm saying.
When the,
he sent her out and then he went running after her.
No, but when the Gemara depicts what happened, when it gives those two different views, it actually is very specific about what it was that he got angry about, and it wasn't her looking at somebody else. It's an interesting point, but the rationalist in me would just look at it and say it's because this is the grammatically correct word for people who are in a relationship, whatever this pilegish relationship is, and she walks out. It's not a term for infidelity, but it's a term for walking away from the relationship that you're in, much like Vizanach Arei Eloheinu Chararetz. It's not necessarily a term for infidelity as much as it is a term for walking away.
So it is criticizing her, even for whatever reason she walked
away. I think it's criticizing her. I think it's making a statement of fact, which is she was in a relationship with him, she left. You know, she walked away from the relationship, which she did. Yeah, that's the way I would look at it.
Does this have this phrase of fear, does this have any connection with the fear of Hashem, or not really? Like,
oh, Eima? It's not the term we usually use. No, usually we use the word Yira.
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 No, the English, like the... Yeah. The sort of secular is fear, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of ways you could translate yirah based on context.
Okay.
Sometimes yirah really is a fear word. Very often it's reverence. A lot depends on context.
Okay.
So the other point, though, that I wanted to highlight here goes back to Ricky's suggestion that maybe Isha was his name, is that no one here has names. Hmm. Right? He's a Levi. She's a Pilagesh. Then there's the Pilagesh's father. We're not going to find out their names. And this isn't going to be like the story with Pesal Micha where Yonatan ben Gershom is going to show up at the end and they'll have to figure out, you know, how he's related to Moshe. There are no names in this story.
But Isha is not a name.
Right,
Isha
no, I think that's what I'm saying.
Man went
correct, before. That's what I'm saying. There are no names in this story. So my question is why?
It's a terrible lesson.
Meaning?
Is it
an hypothetical? Right. Not
just
chance.
Something
it didn't really happen.
No, we definitely have to read this as having happened. Unfortunately, yeah. Sorry, Ruth.
It is related to somebody, and they don't want to shame them.
So I would see this as not protecting anybody because ultimately we're going to convict the entire tribe of Binyamin. Yeah.
Maybe things are so bad at this point. It could have been a story about anyone who lived in this period, not a specific
right.
person.
So I think you could read it. I have two approaches. That's one of them, is to say that it's saying anybody could fall into that, much like, on the flip side, the beginning of Parshas Shmos.
You said we have to read it as though it happened, so it's
yeah.
not anyone, it's a specific.
Yeah. Case. No, but I'm saying that anybody
it's
could
relevant.
Have. It's a moral message.
It
it's a moral message of don't say, if we give you a name, then you'll say that person was terrible.
Everyone else was good.
This is saying that in the same way that in the beginning of Shmos, right, it says a man from the house of Levi went and married the daughter of Levi, and it gives you this whole story of the birth of Moshe until he's 3 months old and everything, and we don't really get names in the, even though it's called the Book of Names, the Shmot. We don't get names, and one of the classic explanations for that is to say anybody could be that great. Anybody at any time could step up and be that great, and therefore we omit the names. This is the opposite. Anybody could be that terrible. And when you don't have a melech b'Yisrael, when you don't have leadership, then people can really, people can fall.
Is it also saying that this was sort of widespread practice? That
I hope not. I mean, that was coming next is definitely not widespread practice because there would be no Jews left. We're not done. I've only started this story. Like, we're three sentences into three chapters. Yeah.
I was going to say, why then this story versus we've read a lot of other terrible things that people have done?
Because you've never seen anything as bad as this story.
Right, but meaning you were saying it could have been anyone, but everyone was bad, so why not every story where someone is doing bad, it could be generic names.
Yeah. And it could be just because this one is so bad, like this one really stands apart, that it's warranted. All right. I'm not sure that's good or not.
Like it's so unbelievable, I mean, if it's so bad that you would want a name to say it really happened to so-and-so. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, maybe. And you have, again, you identify the tribe of Binyamin, and you have real places identified.
Right.
The other possibility that I'd suggest goes back to the story of Rus. Right? There's somebody in there who doesn't get a name. Pliny Almoni, right? Pliny Almoni just is John Doe. He doesn't have a name there. And he's the one who refuses to marry Rus because he doesn't want to ruin his estate. It's going to mean that he's going to have to share his property with whatever kids he has from her. He doesn't want to mess up his estate. And I think it's Radak who says the reason why his name is not given in the book is because somebody who will not help others doesn't deserve any better. He doesn't deserve to have his name mentioned. In which case, you could apply that here as well because of the rotten things that you're going to see happen here. Oh, the father-in-law is going to welcome him into the house.
And then, I guess, nobody would want to name their children after somebody who's responsible for such.
That's certainly true. Yeah, you don't want to name after anybody in this story. That's true. Those names would disappear.
So that could be another reason?
I suppose. Not to keep that name around. That's all you need is to have, yeah.
You mentioned,
I suppose.
Why did he wait 4 months?
Yeah. So
if she did have a relation with somebody else and then went to her father's, then I guess he waited 4 months to see that she's
see
not
she's
carrying any baby.
Right. Could be.
But she didn't know that she was.
But it's possible that I would assume that he's waiting her out.
Okay.
If this is really a financial thing, then he's waiting for her to come back to him, and then after 4 months, he says, you know, it's not happening, and so he goes after her. Maybe, I don't know. But let's see. We have a few minutes till we can see more of this story. Look what happens in Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4. Vayachazek bo chosino aviha. Correct.
They were married.
So again, it could, but it doesn't have to. We don't have jargon for a concubine relationship. That's the problem. We only have the term for her of pilagesh and pilagshut for the ban, but I don't think that proves it. Although again, there are those who do read it as you're suggesting. Vayachazek bo chosino aviha nara. So the girl's father holds on to him. He isn't just happy to see him. He says, stay a while. He stays for 3 days, because that's your standard duration for things in Tanakh, right? Mm-hmm. 3 day periods. We do things for 3 days. They ate, they drank, they stayed. Day 4, they get up early in the morning. He gets up to leave. And the girl's father says to his son-in-law, whatever son-in-law means, Sa'ad libcha pas lechem. Have some bread. Fill your heart with bread. Be'achar te'leichel and then go. Stay for breakfast. Vayeshavu. So they sat. Pasuk Vav. Vayochlu shnehem yachdav. The two of them ate together. Vayishtu and they drank. Vayomer avian aroi ha'ish. And then the father of the girl said to the man, Ho'el na velin v'yitav libecha. Would you please stay? Your heart will be good. Relax a little bit. Don Mikra says, your heart will be good, we'll leave, we'll part on good terms. Stick around. Vayakam ha'ish l'leches. Guy gets up to go. He's had enough. Vayivtzar bochosino. And his father-in-law nudges him. Vayasha vayolensham. And so, alright, fine. And he stays there overnight. Vayashkein baboker. He gets up in the morning. Vayom ha'chamishi. This is now day 5. L'leches, to go. Vayomar avianara. And the girl's father says, Sa'ad na levavcha, have a meal, v'hismahmehu ad netos hayom, and stay, delay, until the day has had a chance to extend, meaning until the afternoon when the sun is moving already into the west. That's where the Dat Mikra takes it. Vayochlu shneihem, and again they have a meal. Vayakam, actually I'm going to stop with that.
Where's the girl?
Right, so whole bunch of questions. Question number one is, where is she? What role does she play in this conversation? That's one question. Seriously, what is going on?
She's in the women's.
What is going on? Not only that, tell me something. How many different ways can we describe the father-in-law here? What is he identified as? Cosno and Eddie said it.
And the father of
the girl. Why are we going back and forth? That's another point. Oh boy, that would be interesting. But that, I'm not sure how you would do that.
What did you say?
Twins.
Right. But also the fundamental question as you read this, why does the father want them to stay?
Well,
what are they pushing for?
We have to wait and see. Maybe they're together. Maybe, I guess, they got back together.
Yeah, so let him go home.
Maybe he doesn't want to go out of the lease. He's waiting for a dowry.
Another dowry? Because now they're getting back together again.
Something evil or bad will happen.
Well, something bad is going to happen. So there are a whole bunch of different explanations. I would like to say this was like Pesel Micha, and it's highlighting hospitality, and you want people to stick around. But I don't think that's what's going on. I don't think you could really suggest that. Take a look at your sheet. I brought you a few different explanations. Malvin says in source number 7. He says there are two different motivations, and that's why the name changes. He says, "Vayirei Avina Arab, father of the girl saw him, and Vayachzek Bo Chosno, his father-in-law held him. Hashemos Bo Lefiha Inyan, the names come according to the subject. Names, not names, but titles. Samach Bo, he was glad to see him. Mitzad Shuavia, because he's her father. That's Avina Arab." He doesn't want her to be bound as an aguna. Now, she's not an aguna because she can go off to somebody else. I think he's speaking to the difficulty of starting a new relationship. I think that's what he means.
To be together.
Yes.
As opposed to her.
Correct. And then the Hafzig Bo, he held on to him, since he's the father-in-law, he says, come on, you got to stay. He has a certain power within the family that gets him to stay. But according to the Malbim's read, it's that he wants to make sure they're really going to be together. He wants to make sure to cement the relationship. Ralbag and the Barbanel give an entirely different perspective. Ralbag in source number 8. He says, "Vayirei Avianara, father saw him. Vayismach lekraso, was happy to greet him. Vayidmeh, it appears, shezeha ish halevi hayanichbad meod. This Levi wasn't just anybody. He had stature in the community. He was honored. Ulezei shtadel chabdo meod Avianara, and that's why he wanted to honor him. This is a real citizen. I want to make sure to show him proper honor. Yeah.
He had such stature." He wouldn't have needed to necessarily do this for a monetary reason.
No, the stature was the lady. The stature was the lady, the husband. Not the husband, the guy with the
luggage. Yeah. Sorry, not the father.
So the father-in-law wants him in his house.
Right.
To me, though, I think the fundamental answer is, going back to what I said about the whole Pilegish element of this story, this is a greed thing. The father, in my mind, the father sold her off. The father could not support her and sold her off instead. And now he is anticipating this fellow's day. He wants to make him happy. There's money in the family. Maybe he'll get some money from him. I read it like a Lavan story, right? Lavan with Eliezer and then Lavan with Yaakov. That's the way. I have to be honest and say that I haven't seen this in the classic commentators, but to me, this is so belated. It's so visible within this, especially because this whole section is focused on what people will do for money. Ruth, you were going to say?
I still don't understand why he would, if that was the case, why didn't he marry her to him?
Because the guy doesn't want to get married. The guy isn't interested.
But he's the only one to have her taken care of.
Yeah. That's the idea.
Does the length of stay some indicative of trying, the father-in-law trying to make him feel more obligated?
Did
he stay somewhere for one night?
So you feel a greater obligation. That could be.
But the longer you made to stay, you think, right. Oh my gosh,
Could be. It's entirely possible.
Because he's someone of kavod.
Right. The other note that I'll just make, just to highlight the connection to the idol of Micha, is in Pasuk Vav, in sentence 6, we said, Ho'el na velin, right? If you go back to Yudchet Yud Aleph, 1811, with the Levi, was it 18 or was it 17? Sorry, 1711. Yud Zion Yud Aleph, right? When he tries to get the Levi to stay, right? Vayoel HaLevi, Lashemes HaSa'ish. At the time, we made the connection to Moshe from that Vayoel. But the same term is used for staying in both of these stories. We're using the same language. There's a lot more to talk about in the language of this story, but that's going to have to wait till next week. But right now, what we've seen is the number one, we understand more about Pilagesh and the nature of this relationship that's going on.
We understand the Pilagesh.
Yes.
But we don't understand it, I'm not sure. Right. That's what it is.
There are, well, they, we know what it is, we think, in general, what a Pilagesh is. It's this relationship without the benefits that, of his protection for her, or the permanence of a marriage. There's no need for a get. We understand that odds are this is a financial relationship. She left. She walked away. Whether she walked away because he yelled at her about something where we learn you should not yell, or whether she left and indeed it was about infidelity is unclear. But he comes after 4 months.
And the father,
she brings him to the house.
That she's there.
I would think. It's 4 months already. And so she brings him in, and the father-in-law is happy for him to stay and to get back together with the Pilagesh. We'll have to see more about this, God willing, next week.